I'm all ready to go.
Okay, well, let's
Recording in
go.
progress. There you go.
Sorry for rambling on. So, welcome to the June 8th, 2021 session of Tangerine SDR and HAMSAI technical session. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on a couple of things. I had a session with Nathaniel and Kong and Scotty, and we talked about getting going on the FPGA code. So that was good. And I've actually done a little bit of work getting ready for that, trying to get a block diagram or a diagram that is FPGA centric pulled together. And I have some questions about that later. Anyway, that's it for me. Next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Things have been quite busy here. I'm supervising about 8 students this summer and working with Dev, of course. And things are moving along. So, of course, I met with Dave and Scotty and Kung about the Tangerine FPGA. And yeah, just keep moving along with everything. So, W2NF, back to net.
Fine business. Next on the list, we have Dan. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, thanks, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Well, this week, I guess all I did that's been productive is work on a script to install Python 3.9.5 on Ubuntu Mate for the Raspberry Pi. And I've got it working. I have a little bit of an issue in that my Odroid N2, which is what I really built it for, the power supply died on it. So I need to buy a new wall wart to make the thing work. But other than that, I've not done a tremendous amount. Been busy with other stuff. Anyway, back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, and for something to break, that's about the least expensive part. Anyway, very good. Next on the list, we have Dev, KC3PVE. Go ahead, Dev.
Hello, good evening, everyone. So we have started our week here at the University of Scranton with a group meeting, and we have reviewed. There was a presentation by a member of the group, and we have set tasks for ourselves for this week, and I hope to fulfill my goal. Thank you.
Very good. Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thanks, Dave. Good evening to you. Good evening to the net. Had a low level of continuous activity here. Did quite a bit of work on figuring out, oh, there's complexities with regard to putting metadata into digital RF. And when you're trying to record data and you try and put additional metadata into the properties file, it rejects it, blah, blah, blah. So we have an auxiliary metadata file, which we're going to have to find out how to extract data from, which is not a problem. It's just a bit shocking for the students that I have working on this. Worked a bit with Dave Witten on getting the right scripts to work for uploading, secure uploading of a magnetometer data. And we've got something working on that. You might have seen I posted a thing on the Tapper email about testing of magnetometer RF suppression. And what I discovered, we talked a little bit about in the past week or two about the noise that seems to be coming out of the magnetometer in some way. And I tested with putting ferrite chokes on either end of the Cat 6 cable. That didn't make any difference. But what I found out is that a Raspberry Pi connected to a wall wart is actually not grounded anywhere. Okay, so what I discovered is if I run a cable, okay, from my heavy duty ground in the shack, which goes to buried rods in the earth and all of that, and ground the Raspberry Pi, then most of the noise goes away. The birdie on 160 meters disappears entirely. The noise on 160 meters disappears, and the noise on 80 meter is cut by in less than half. So what I did was I found out, you know, the Raspberry Pi version 4 has a nice, it has an audio jack, but you don't have to use the whole jack. You can use just the ring of it to get a good ground to the Raspberry Pi. So I ran a cable from the ring part of the audio jack on the Raspberry Pi to my shack ground, and most of the noise on the that's coming from the magnetometer is gone away, because now all of a sudden the shield of the Cat 6 is actually connected to a ground. Okay, so that's a lesson learned that we should bear in mind for, you know, in terms of, well, if people who are interested in 80 meter DXing are really the only people who will be affected by this, but we need to make sure that you ground your Raspberry Pi. So that's what was learned today. Back to Ned.
Fine business. And yes, I also got my magnetometer R-Sync working as well. So there's at least two of us on there, other than Dave. And okay, next on the list, we have Bob, or excuse me, Bo, WB4GZK. Go ahead, Bo.
Well, thank you. Just sitting in tonight to find out what's going on. So I have no further traffic, and I'll just keep listening.
Well, fine business. And if you find it interesting, please come back.
Thank you.
Next on the list, we have Kong. Go ahead, Kong.
Good evening, everyone. So this week, I mainly tried to catch up with what Dave sent me over the email, which was the GitHub link to the project we've been working on, the Tangerine SDR. And I also looked at the block diagram that he sent me on the Hermes. And also, I also just received the Linux desktop from Dr. Frizzell. So this afternoon, I set up quarters on that machine. So that is ready to be used. And that's pretty much it. And I might have questions later on the project itself.
Well, I have some questions for you as for discussion as well later.
Thank you.
So next on the list is Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Yes, I've been working with several people, Dave, Jules, Bill, I don't know, anybody else, trying to get some intelligible documentation on how to operate the magnetometer with the software that is currently available. And I was trying to standardize it. I'm not aware of any OS standard or anything else that had been decided. So I've been sticking straight to pure Raspberry Pi OS, you know, version of Debian, and but trying to keep things generic, try to keep things so they'll compile or operate on pretty much any machine. But once in a while, I slip up. Actually, a lot of the time, I slip up. But and there's been lots of bugs, and then making things a set of instructions that anyone can actually bear to follow. I think of the four of us using it at this point, no two are really doing it quite the same. And some of them for very good reasons, some of them, you know, just because of choice. But there's what I'm trying to do is a baseline using a Raspberry Pi 3 or 4 to operate the magnetometer. We can do whatever derivatives we need from that when decisions are made. I think it's I'm still working on that documentation. Nothing out there is the last word. So I just made a few edits a minute ago. So we'll continue. It's just a reference and something for those who want to move ahead. There's something to work from. Also, Human has reworked some of what I put out there quite a while back. And we probably need to do another iteration of that into, I guess that's on a Google. Trouble is we're putting this a lot of different places, and keeping them updated and versionized is something that worries me a lot. I'm putting everything into my GitHub and putting links into it from places. Anything else, anybody's welcome to ask me where that is, and we can move it elsewhere, but I'm going to be keeping a copy there so I can kind of keep track of my versioning. There's really just no other way with Google Drive or things like that to do, that I'm aware of, to realistically keep the version straight. So, but that's a work in progress, bigger task than it really sounded like it would be. And I hope it's useful. Over.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have David N1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Hello, all. I haven't had a chance to respond on the magnetometer interference, but I do have experience to offer. I'm not at all surprised at what has been found. We found very similar in our experiments, installations out in the field. A lot of noise gets conducted out of cables on the outside. And as I've heard it put, we are our own worst enemy. That isn't strictly true, but a lot of our noise.
David, your mic went out.
Hello?
Now I can hear you, but it's a different kind of mic.
Now, okay.
Okay, I can hear you.
Well, all right. I don't know why this keeps cutting out. Your phones are doing funny things. Anyway, we have a lot of installations out in the field. We know that noise gets conducted out the outside of the cables. We've done a lot of work putting very heavy chokes on them with some success, taking a cable and wrapping it around a large toroid of appropriate absorbent material, ferrite. You want to keep any electronics that you can inside a closed metal box, of course. And that's one thing that we haven't been doing, I think, with our Raspberry Pi systems. So the noise is, going out rather than necessarily being generated out at the far end. I guess I was expecting the magnetometer to generate some noise of its own, but it sounds like it's more the processor noise going out. One thing that we find in the snow is it makes a very good inside out transmission line with the dielectric of the snow around the cable. It's amazing how far that noise can go. It can go a mile. We've got stuff at like 1,500 feet to 2,500 feet in Antarctica, South Pole, and our computer noise gets out there. We've learned to null antennas, for instance. There was another instrument that is a imaging rheometer that we've coexisted with. We've had to null our antenna to their cable to get the noise out. So this is a known problem. There are ways that we've used to take care of it, but shield everything and choke everything. And so, it'll be interesting once we get these out in the field with receiving systems, what we end up getting. Unfortunately, I have receiving capability here of 160 and 80. I have not tested it. I also don't have shielded cable. So that might be a worst case that I can offer to see what radiation we're getting. But for this project, we're certainly going to want to get a good handle on whatever noises are being generated at the end of the cable, but more importantly, it seems to be at the processor end. So back to Net.
Well, fine business. And next on the list is, let's see, Gary, AF8A. Go ahead, Gary.
Good evening, everyone. Just copying the mail. So back to Net.
Okay, fine business. And next on the list is Hyoman, KD2MCR.
Good evening, everyone. I've been working on the documentation mostly. As you can see, I shared the document with others. Currently, there are three documents. One document focuses more on installation and operation, which is kind of main document. And then we have one document that talks about sensor housing, which Jules provided. I guess Jules is not here today, but thank you very much for the documentation. The third documentation is what Dave Witten provided for the software operation. So I'm thinking whether I would like to ask you guys whether we have to integrate all these documentations so that we can have one place to look at, or we just keep three documentation as it is. Otherwise, I'm still working on it with some more pictures that would help readers understand what's going on. I think the documentation is going to be almost done. Although I also have to add some more description, but I think most of the parts in the document are very close to being done. So that's what I've been working on. Second issue that I want to share with you guys is that, well, I guess Nathaniel is already know about this, the Eclipse project in Antarctica. There are a group of scientists who are interested in iceberg effect during eclipse. And one idea that came up from one of the meetings that I attended is that we can provide the grape to for the BASS, British Antarctic Survey, because one of their stations is under the totality of the eclipse. So it will be interesting to operate one of our IHF receiver system down there, if that's possible, to deliver one of our grape system down there before the eclipse starts, which is early December. I guess to be able to be deployed, we have to ship it somewhere by, I guess, October-ish, November-ish. So that's something that we have to consider. That'll give us very a good opportunity to make our effort more visible, but also scientifically it will be very beneficial and very synergistic. So I'll be talking with Nathaniel later. But that just came out from the meeting that I just attended today. So
yeah. Hyoman, the person we should talk to is Christina Collins, because she's already working on hardening one and preparing one for McMurdo Station. So we have got two options. One is to take that one that's headed toward McMurdo and redirect it to BASS. The second option is I have the base, now that Christina has experience doing this, I have a base platform that I could send her a second one, and then she could potentially put together a second one based on her experience with the first.
Yep.
So, but she would be the best person to do this for Antarctica.
Yep. Well, also, I have a very good relationship with German Institute, AVI, who operates a station down in Antarctica, which is kind of close to British Antarctic Station. So, you know, they might also be interested in putting one of our system down there. Although that station is not under totality, but still, you know, I guess, simply speaking, the more the better, I guess, so.
Yeah, I would talk to Christina and see what she's capable of, because she's got the most experience putting that together right now.
Yep. Okay. But anyways, yep, that's all I have. Back to Ned.
Okay. And I will mention we have a website, tangerinesdr.com, which we can put documents at. Not everybody has posting privileges. One way that you can do that is exactly what Dave Whitten suggested. If you put it on your own GitHub, I can point a link on the Tangerine SDR to your GitHub, to the actual document. And then that way you have control over editing and versioning, but we have it available for other people to read. So just contact me if you want to do that with some document you want to work on.
Yeah, and I meant to say, yes, it needs to be in one place, at least have links available.
Yes.
Otherwise it just gets.
Yes. We're trying to, originally Scotty asked me to pull together a website for that purpose. So, and it, the website was designed that way. So next on the list, we have James KG4DSG. Go ahead, James.
Good evening, all. I'm just listening in as usual. I did have one quick question for Bill. You mentioned with the noise issue, you mentioned shielding on the Cat 6. Are you using shielded Cat 6 cable?
Yes.
You are? Yes. Is the Raspberry Pi housing shielded or grounded?
The magnetometer module is.
Okay, so the grounding, the shield on the Cat 6 is grounded at the magnetometer.
That's why it grounds the Raspberry Pi. If you ground the Pi, then it goes up through the connector and connects to the shielded connector on the magnetometer, and then everything's grounded. Right, so, Bill?
That's my understanding. I mean, well, you can hook it up different ways, but from my understanding, the best way to do it is to ground the Cat 6 just at one point closest to your shack ground. And then, so you don't want to have a ground loop where your Cat 6 is grounded to both ends. You want to ground it at the Pi. So,
but there's also a jumper. There's a jumper on the board to connect to the Cat 6 shield or the Cat 5 shield. But on the far end, there's basically no ground, even if you put that jumper on, because it's inside a pipe, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what you want.
Because otherwise it turns into an antenna.
You want it grounded at both ends. You don't want it floating.
Tom had strong opinions about that.
So
RF, you want it grounded.
Well, so the recommendation is going to be grounded or shielded Cat 6 for the magnetometer?
Yes, but that is not an internet connection. That's just a.
But no, I've been all along. We've really discussed essentially Cat 6A, which is kind of double shielded, I believe. Cat 6, which allows us to pass the grounding through our connectors all the way up the chain. And yes, it was designed presumably to be grounded at one end or the other. And I'm not an expert on the whys and wherefores of that, but Tom McDermott had strong feelings about that subject.
Even if you put the jumper on the far end, all that does is connect the shield to the logic ground of the magnetometer board. It doesn't actually do any grounding because it's a plastic pipe.
And it doesn't really need to be. You just want complete metallic envelopment of the electronics at the far end as best you can accomplish and connect that to the shield. So David's got it just right, I think.
Yeah. So you put the jumper on both ends then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, otherwise you make the magnetometer an antenna.
Okay. I just wanted clarification on that. That back to the net.
Okay, and next on the list we have Jay. Where'd you go? WB8SBI.
Hi, good evening, everybody. Not a whole heck of a lot here. The only problem I'm having these days is actually a laptop problem. And that is when I powered down my laptop and disconnected the power supply, the power brick, and then I went to plug it back in, it didn't work. There was no indication that the power was getting from the brick from the power supply actually into the laptop itself. I checked the brick itself and it was working fine. So And after having had this experience a couple times, there's something about my laptop, and I don't know if it's the connector, the power connector, or if there's something internal in the circuitry that when the external power supply goes away, it stops working until it decides to start working again. So until, and so I've ordered a new laptop, and I'll demote this one to spare or just make it my FTH station or something like that. And then I just have to go through the process of commissioning and configuring and putting all the programs onto my new laptop. But that's really weird. Has anyone ever had something like that happen before?
I've had issues where the battery on the laptop is problematic and was making poor contact. And so when it was on AC, everything worked okay. When you unplug the AC, the battery would work for a while, and then either the battery would suddenly fail or a battery contact would open and it would crash. The computer, of course, would lose power of that. That's the only direct experience I've had.
And I've had connectors actually come loose from the PC board. Like if you sit the laptop down and bend the connector up, it breaks the solder joint inside, and so you can't ever charge the battery. So battery runs down, then the laptop's no good anymore.
Yeah, I see right now it seems to be functioning. It seems to be okay. The battery is fully charged, but I'm not taking any chances, so I'm leaving this thing plugged in. I can power it down, which I have done, so I can do a complete power down and shut off, and it will turn back on. But until I get my new laptop, it's like, I'm a little bit hesitant to move this thing and to do too much with it. Other than that, saw a real interesting film tonight, courtesy of the Southeast Michigan chapter of the IEEE on Nikola Tesla. And one thing I didn't know of historical note is that after Tesla died, his patents, Marconi used his patents, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Marconi had usurped the patents and that Tesla was the proper owner of many of the patents that Marconi used to accomplish all the work he did. Now, it was after Tesla died, so, and he had no estate, no heirs, so there's nothing, no money could change hands, but it was a historical note that Marconi used patents without permission to accomplish much of what he did. And that Nikola Tesla was the proper owner of the patents, and that is per the U.S. Supreme Court. So little historical note there. Other than that, 73 at all, back to net control, and get ready for field day.
Okay. Next on the list is Jim K4BSE. Go ahead, Jim.
Good evening. Well, not a lot here. I've been trying to clean up a little bit of the documentation on the Grape One. And since workout to Gary the other day, I had been saying I was going to do some assembly notes on the PC board, which I did. But they kind of blew up on me a little more than I expected. And so, Gary, I hope you can make something of those. I guess you have an understanding with Christina now, I guess, about where all that's going to be published. We can talk about that Thursday, but just so noting, I do plan to, there's one picture I want to take, I think may help some, kind of walking a fine line there between documenting it thoroughly and not really encouraging people too much to try to build a thing because that thing kind of took on its life of its own that nobody intended and don't want people doing the good work on the next version of the Grape to get distracted by having to support this one. That's about it. Back to Ned.
Fine business. And next on the list is Jonathan, KC3EEY. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. There was some really good discussion about the noise issue with the magnetometer. These were a lot of issues that I've ran into with my VLF receivers. Bill, I was wondering, the shield of your Cat 6, that's definitely grounded, right, on the connector?
To the best of my knowledge, yes. The thing is, I bought a commercially prepared cable, and I had to take one end of it, on the magnetometer, the buried part of it. I had to take the cable apart in order to run it through the waterproofing and everything else. But on the side that's in the shack, it's just as it came from the factory, and it was a shielded Cat 6 purchased that way. So is it grounded? All I can say is, I guess so. I mean, it acts like it is, because it does have, whether the case is grounded or not, definitely impacts the noise. You can see it right there in the waterfall.
Okay. Yeah, because when I do my VLF receiver installs, I make sure to ground the shield on both ends. And for the audio, I use isolation transformers. And for power, I use isolated switching supplies if I'm supplying power from the inside. If not, then I'm supplying it from a battery on the outside. So that was that kind of made me wonder, is there a possibility that we could use optical isolation on both ends of magnetometer? That could be one way to mitigate noise. The other option, other thing that I was wondering is why I2C was used instead of something like a RS-485 ASCII serial.
Jonathan?
Somebody's phone is ringing.
Jonathan?
Yes.
Just as a point of interest, and nothing I want to be held to, but I have a half kilometer of actually plastic fiber. It requires two pieces, so I could get a quarter of a kilometer with it. Using some small devices, SparkFun was selling. Unfortunately, their setup only uses RS-232. We were interested in, for a variety of reasons, in I2C. I might have to convert, but I was planning to experiment. In fact, I've done a little bit of experimentation with this fiber setup, a lot cheaper than the, single mode long haul fiber or something like that. This is it's a 2.8 millimeter. Is that right?
Dave, I think it's a 1 millimeter polymethacrylate.
Okay. Yes. You've seen it. Okay. I do have that.
We use it as a throughway for all of our RS-232 runs out to toll plazas. So we use tons of it.
Oh, really? Okay. I had planned to ask you about it. And in any case, I had planned to play with it and see what that did. Of course, it requires a mechanism to power the remote end, because you have no electrical connection to the, it's all optical, but it does have the advantage of being quiet. That's just something.
One of the things I noted was that we didn't see any spectral lines at the clock frequencies. And to me, that indicates that we're not seeing I2C noise.
That's great. This bit of playing around is just curiosity on my part, but but it is an option in some situation, might be an option in some situations where there are some other problems.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Since you asked.
Yeah. And Tom, that's a good point, because I was wondering too, whether that was iceberg sea noise or whether that was noise from the clock of magnetometer.
My guess is it's actually noise conducted down the cable that's from the Raspberry Pi, probably not anything to do with the magnetometer.
Oh, okay. Okay, well right. And Bill's experiment kind of validates that.
Yeah, that's my takeaway from it.
Okay, yeah. All right. Good. Well, I'm experimenting with an optical audio link with my VLF receivers, and I also use audio isolation transformers. And you know, I use either magnetic or optical isolation for my VLF receivers. That's what kind of sparked my thinking about this problem. So it's a good thing that this issue came up, because it's probably going to come up again, and it's good to try to understand how to mitigate this problem, because it's very important for VLF, and it's also important for things like magnetometer. Other than that, I've been working on a little tester box for my active VLF antenna that I'll be installing at Nathaniel when he gets a chance to install his magnetometer. What it's going to do, it's going to power the active VLF antenna, and it has an LM4881 headphone amplifier and some connectors and a volume adjustment and headphone jack for testing and making sure that the active VLF antenna is working and producing audio like it should. So I had a spare Hammond enclosure. They're so handy to have. I had a spare one, and I bought this little headphone amp board for that purpose. So I'm working on getting that ready. So if there are issues with the active VLF antenna and it's not getting audio to the Raspberry Pi, this can verify that the VLF antenna itself is working. So it's a good tool to diagnose any issues. Other than that, I have nothing to report. Back to the net.
Well, fine business. And let's see. Next on the list is Joe W7LUX. Go ahead.
Stand by one. Okay. Good evening, everybody. Been just monitoring WWV with the grape and responding to Christina's request for some ideas about interference. I've got quite a few standards running here, 5 and 10 megahertz standards, and they do interfere with the radio when I've got auxiliary equipment connected to the standard. The standard is sitting there running by itself with no connections to the signal port. Seems to not bother the radio, at least not that I can tell. However, the problem is that while there's no obvious indication of interference, there may be insidious interference, in that I ran some plots back in the last 2 days of May and the first 2 days of June, and the first two plots in the last of May had the interference due to equipment connected to the standard. The two in early June, June 1 and June 2, did not have that interference. I disconnected the stuff from the GPS DO, the HP GPS DO, and I saw no more of a trace of interference, and the signal amplitude, or the amplitude of the Doppler shift, was significantly larger on June 1 and 2 than it was on May 30 and 31, when there was considerable interference. anyway, that's what I've got. And just sitting here, I'm late because I was typing a reply to Christina. Anyway, very good evening to everybody. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. And next on the list, we have Jules K2KGJ. Go ahead, Jules.
Okay. So I was fortunate in being able to install Dave's new firmware this week and get on to the exporting my data to his setup. That seems to be working well now. And thanks, Dave, for all the help on that. Finally got the path straight. With respect to noise on the Cat 6 cable, a couple of things. I think I sent out a scope image earlier in the week that looked at the transient current at the far end, at the remote end. This is on 100 and some 10 feet of Cat 6, that the I2C differential extender at that end draws when it's transmitting back to the local. Transient appears on the cable, on the power lines, and can be substantially, as you saw on the scope traces, substantially reduced by an appropriate size low ESR capacitor on the 5-volt line at the remote end. Okay, number one. Two, when we first started playing with the Cat 5, shielded Cat 5, the first setup I tried had the power and ground, the 5-volt power and ground combined on, shared on two twisted pairs. That is, I had each twisted pair carried power and ground, and the two of those were placed in parallel so that the power and ground was actually over a twisted pair, not as in the current situation where there are two separate twisted pairs, one for power, one for ground. I have not had a chance to do an analysis of radiated EMI, conducted EMI in the shield due to common mode currents, but radiated due to the possibility of that separation of 5-volt and ground into two separate twisted pairs. I'm going to have to restore my original connection and try that, but I'll just pass that on, and that's it for here. Back to the net. Go ahead.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Khan. Are you still there? Go ahead.
Yeah. Hey, guys. I'm still here. I'm participating in that the Eclipse Digi right now, and I do get a lot of noise. So this this whole grounding thing is pretty helpful. I know I had to ground some stuff, but I didn't. I guess I'm gonna have to do it. So I just bought some shielded Cat 6 cables just like 2 minutes ago. So and what is it? And I'm gonna. There's a few other things I want to do too, but when I do it, I'll update you guys next week or something. But as for now, that's it. Back to that.
Okay. And next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK. Go ahead, Mike. Hey. Well. Okay, and I did see Bill N8ET jump in there. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I've got nothing to report. I've been up working at the boat and came home for one day, took my wife to the night doctor's appointment, and I headed back to the boat tomorrow. So nothing here, and missed most of that anyways. Back to you.
Okay, and next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, thanks, Dave. And let's see, this week spent some time working with the CAD guy on length matching for the differential pairs. Went through the rules with him, and he's off doing the length matching now. We've got all the physical connections made, and got almost all of the pins connected up to things in the FPGA image. I've got a little bit more to do there. And the CAD guy, he thinks he's going to be done by the end of this week with all of the length matching and cleanup and everything that we have. So then we're back down to waiting for the part, the one last part that I'm having trouble getting, which is the FPGA. And that's a whole other story that I won't bore everyone with, but it's the comedy of errors on Intel's and Arrow's part. So I was still working that issue. And then, of course, there were some unrelated fires this week on other projects that had to be taken care of. So it's been pretty busy this week. So the last week, I should say. So back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And now we have Tom in N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, very good. Real quick, can I be controlled to share the screen? I have two slides. Okay, does this slide show up?
Yes.
Okay, so I've set up a measurement for looking at spurs in the receiver, and this I prototyped the test on Hermes, but we'll move this test over to Tangerine when we get to that point. The Hermes receiver's got a 50 ohm resistor feeding the receiver, and there's a wide band output on Hermes that puts out 16,000 samples and then some dead time, and then 16,000 samples. And it has to do that because it only has 100 meg Ethernet, and it couldn't keep up with wideband samples at any faster. And then we look at the spectrum through an FFT. The samples coming out are real. So I throw away half of the vector samples and keep half. And the box here that says array of IIR filters, that's 8,192 IIR filters in that block that filter each of the FFT output channels, and then it goes over, it gets turned into magnitude and then turned into dB and vector sync. And this is what I actually measured on Hermes. And you can see over on the left side is the DC component. That's the offset voltage from the A to D converter. You can see a little bit of leakage down here in the AM broadcast band, even though I've got a BNC 50 ohm resistor connected right to the input jack. The AM stations still get there. But you can see a couple of pretty substantial spurious components. And these are signals that come out of Hermes even when there's no input signal at all. And I think these are fairly well known. You can see most of the signals down there in the grass fall away because they're averaged by those low-pass filters. But the spurious components don't decrease when you filter them. And so I'm hope this is the test that I think folks were looking for in terms of spurious responses on the receiver. So if there's any comments about this or the methodology, I'd appreciate it. And I can continue to work on this test. But right now, I think this may be what is useful for the Tangerine. And that's all I've got. I can unshare now.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of the list, unless anybody else has jumped in there. I've looked up and down. I can't see anybody we haven't called on. Oh, there's Tom Yarnish. I don't know if he wants to make a comment or not. And no response, so we'll go on. So we're open for general discussion.
Tom, on your graph there, you could expand out the lower scale and maybe see some switch mode power supply spurs or things like that. Is that true?
I'd have to look at it. The resolution is limited by the fact of by the vector size that the Hermes puts out. So I have 7.5 kilohertz between adjacent FFT bins. And so I'm somewhat limited as to how much I can process due to the interrupted sample nature of the receiver.
So on gigabit Ethernet, if we could give you bigger packets, would that would you have enough horsepower to process that?
Yeah, we'll have to see if we can get the wideband samples out from the receiver at full rate at gigi. The way Hermes did it, I think, is clever. They knew they only had 100 meg Ethernet, and they need gigi to get the samples out in real time from the wideband receiver. So their approach was pretty clever, given the limitation that they have.
But Hermes has GigE, doesn't it?
Yeah.
No.
If they implemented it, I mean,
they didn't change the wideband after they built it.
There's a second problem. The gigabit Ethernet on the Hermes module doesn't work properly. There's a power supply issue on the Hermes board.
Oh, right.
It makes it not function correctly at 8 gigabit.
It's that little FET regulator or buffer chip, right, is underpowered, under heat sink. Right.
And so I think that the FPGA image was also too small to accommodate. You know, there were three or four things that ganged up that prevented that.
Yeah, but we'll be able to generate UDP at a gigabit speed. So I figured out at 16 bits IQ, that's about 20 megahertz width of bandwidth. So if we were to make it just real data, then we could give you a lot more bandwidth.
Well, you only have real data coming out of an ADD converter. That's just the raw samples. So
right, but if you want just raw samples, you don't want filtered anything filtered.
Well, in the wideband mode, which is what this test runs, you just want the raw real samples from the converter. That's how you can characterize the converter.
So we could run, if that my calculations right, gigabit Ethernet is about 100 megabytes per second, right? So that's about 50 mega samples per second plus minus the overhead.
Well, so one converter puts out 2 bytes per sample, right? Because it's a 14-bit converter. So 2 bytes times 122.88 mega samples per second.
250 megabytes per second.
Right. Times 8 bits per sample is about 2 gigabits. To about 2 gigabits per second.
Well, it's 2 bytes per sample, right? So it's
right. So it's 2 gigabits per second.
Right, which will not fit in our 1 gig. So right. What do we do then? Just give you every other sample? What would be the best way to
burst? Yeah, I'll think about it. If we can get longer bursts than 16384, we can get better resolution.
I think we could easily do that because we have a big RAM on there. So,
So if we can get a burst, a long burst, and then dead time, and a long burst and dead time, we can zero in a lot closer.
Scotty, is the USB available?
Yeah, we could use USB 3, and that runs at 5 gigabits. So that might be a way to just shove raw data out the USB port. And
on Hermes, I wrote 2 different drivers. I wrote a different driver for wideband than for narrowband. And we could do the same thing on Tangerine, just have a wideband driver and a narrowband driver.
And, you know, that would be interesting if we put, we could just shove out full speed IQ data on the USB 3 port and let people use it for what they want. We could do that in parallel. Remember, FPGA is all parallel. So that really, as long as we have space in the FPGA to do that, which is not going to take a whole lot of processing, because USB 3 is just a FIFO. So you set up the endpoints and then you just shove the data out, and it's in hardware speed. So, I mean, you're talking about it takes a few registers. That's it.
Yeah. So there's a couple of other options since you have multiple, but we can talk about those later. I just think, you know, either getting full at rate samples or long bursts, either one will, I think, let us characterize how the converter is working.
Yeah, because the question I really had was if I could give you full speed uninterrupted data, can you process it that fast?
I'm not sure. The GNU radio is doing a pretty respectable job, you know, handling 8,000 filters in parallel, doing things like that. So it probably depends on how powerful the host is.
You're probably not running this on a Raspberry Pi, right?
No, it's running on something with a few more horses under the hood, a
few more cores.
Well, Scotty, after our discussion the other day, I was looking at making some sort of a diagram of what the DE is doing, and I was reading Bill's documentation, and there were a couple of questions that came to mind about that. Why are we using a discovery packet from the HPSDR when none of the other stuff conforms to any of the HPSDR protocols?
What are you talking about, our board?
Yes. So why don't we just make our own discovery packet?
We could do that, but
I think we should avoid confusion.
Well, why make it different? I mean, even if you make it the same, then if some brave soul plugs their Hermes board into our network, we could at least recognize what it is.
Well,
might not talk to it.
The one issue right now is we're colliding with other boards that are undocumented.
How do you mean?
So we picked
1024, right?
Well, one thing is the thing is all in binary, the command that goes back and forth. And we picked number 7 for our which was the last of the documented boards. But if you look in LinHPSDR, there's about 14 of them.
Do they all use different hex numbers, or they all pick 7?
Yeah, it basically tells me that my simulator, which is trying to be a Tangerine SDR, is an Orion.
It's so, just because they made their own. Okay,
have the confusion that Hermes Light is also building boards and using those numbers too.
So I have no problem with that. So you're saying maybe we would send a question mark instead of an O2 or something like that, right? Is that what you mean? So we send an ASCII character.
Yeah, and I mean the whole Bill built the whole thing with ASCII characters. Why can't we just use an ASCII character?
You can do that.
Set for the discovery, and I think it would be simpler and more straightforward.
And then if we want to discover Hermes boards, then we could
build a Hermes discoverer.
Yeah. Or we could reprogram the Hermes to use our...
I mean, we already have that code, so that's not a problem.
Yeah.
That was the one thing that just didn't seem to make sense.
That's fine. It's evolved out of that. So yes. If it makes sense to not do that, then, I mean, we need the function. We don't necessarily need to be compatible.
Yes. I think that's
the reason I did a lot of that stuff that was the same as the older system was so that we could use John Melton's very nicely crafted discovery. It's very error tolerant and it doesn't hang up, and it's able to deal with an awful lot of things. And it was so nice to be able to use that
couldn't you ask John to change a couple of characters in his?
Oh yes, he can add. He can add our stuff too.
Yeah, we got the source. I mean, we got the source. We can make it do whatever we want to.
Whatever makes sense. I'm not certain things I'm really enamored of, but this isn't one of them.
Yeah. So that was one thing. I am trying to figure out. Essentially, in the FPGA code, they talk about the there being a state machine. It's not really a state machine, but the Phils were both enamored by state machines when they started.
The Phils? Oh, both Phil Covington, you mean, and Phil Harmon?
Yes. Okay. And so they were trying to build a state machine in FPGA. And it is a state machine, but it's not really a complete state machine.
I got to tell you a little anecdote that has to do with state machines, and it might make it, maybe it'll make a little sense, but we did this project for Honeywell, and it was, I can talk about it now maybe I shouldn't talk about it now. Anyway, it doesn't matter what it was. The fact is that they had strict software requirements that we were not allowed to use software. Okay, we FPGA code was okay, but if you wrote software, then it had to be certified, and it had to be tested, and all the loops had to be verified, and every instruction had to be executed, all that nonsense. So, but we really wanted to put a NEOS in the thing because it was the easiest way to housekeep and steer things. Even though the high speed stuff was done with state machines, we had to have a NEOS because it was just the easiest way to do it. So what we did is we told the customer that a NEOS processor is a predefined state machine. And in fact, it is kind of. I mean, it has known states. It has known instructions. It behaves in a particular way in response to each particular instruction, and it's all defined. So all it is a CAN state machine. And they accepted it, and they allowed us to use it in housekeeping. Well,
and essentially what I'm trying to do is look at Bill's documentation from the DE side and saying, okay, I get this. What do I know? What do I don't know? What do I have to wait for? And I've been going through his code.
Bill's code?
Bill's code. Bill made a simulator, and I'm trying to be able to explain it to Kong, what he needs to know to write the FPGA code. So that's what I'm doing right now. And
so I wouldn't get too wrapped around the axle on that, because I don't really think that that's the best way to do it.
No, but what it, but there are, so when you turn it on, you're in a, like an, Bill said, a no-op state, and then you're going to have certain things, a discovery coming in, then you know what kind of radio you're talking to, and then there will be the procedural configurations coming in, and then the data lines coming in, and then the dump of INQ, basically. And so you have to be well aware of where you're in that sequence and what you have to do. And
well, and you have to keep track of port numbers and IP addresses and things that are going to be really hard to do in state machines.
And what I'm trying to do is figure out a table or some sort of an organizational way that could be programmed in QRDIS that will do what Bill's C code does.
Well, Bill's simulator code.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's what I'm busy working on.
Well, so you're talking about pretty much how is the NEOS going to control things, as opposed to actually registers in the
but FPGA. Also keep track of where they are.
Well, but that's easy for a processor. It's hard for state machines. They get complicated really fast.
Yes,
so,
I know.
So my opinion is that you take the state machine and you integrate it with the MAC, okay, the Ethernet MAC. And you may take another state machine and integrate it with other pieces, and then you have the NEOS processor talk to all those state machines and steer them.
Right.
And tell them how to behave. And
but essentially, you need some sort of a, there is a sequence that Bill is very nicely detailed in a document. What we need is in the FPGA a way of keeping track of where we are in the sequence. And it's just
isn't that going to be what the NEOS processor does? I mean, it's almost a no-brainer. If you,
well, it's,
you
close.
Can take what Bill's already done and just...
Yeah,
I mean, it's you're going to have to tie it to the hardware some way, which Bill doesn't have, because there's no Mac and all that stuff in the FPGA. But so are you trying to define the line we draw, the interface between the FPGA fabric over here and the NEOS over here? Because the NEOS is going to really run Bill's algorithm, and the FPGA code is going to do the high-speed data transfer. So you want to keep the NEOS processor out of the flow. It sits on the side and directs things, but it doesn't get in the middle of things because it will not be able to keep up.
Yeah, but essentially we need to be able to make a diagram that we can give to Kong to understand where all the pieces are and how they connect.
Okay. But still, I mean, you don't really have...
And we don't have that right now. I did sort of one for the Hermes, which is much simpler.
But you don't really have to get into the details of the state machine to draw the diagram, because the state machine just controls it. The NEO steers it. So,
well,
you know, when you draw a block diagram of a processor over here, the state machine over here, you really don't have to put the code. You don't have to tell me what the code does, right?
So a Hermes just turns things on and off at certain state, and there is a sequence. But
right.
Bill's depends on communication back and forth. And so it will take a little more complicated.
Right, but then essentially what you're going to have is you're going to have a hardware block diagram that's going to show what the blocks are. But then you're going to have a firmware diagram for what goes on inside the NEOS that shows what steps it has to do to control everything and sequence it, right? So now you've got it split into two pieces, which I think is much easier, because try and put it all in one piece like Phil did, hardware block, and then describe how the hardware block works.
Right.
That's hard. How about we put a hardware block over here and a NEOS here, and then let's describe how this controls the hardware block. And that's the piece that you're missing now, is how does the firmware in the NEOS, what does it do? How does it steer things?
Well, yes.
Or am I oversimplifying things?
Well, I'm sitting down trying to read through several different documents and trying to make sense of how they all fit together is
Why Phil's code, I think, is good to look at it to a certain extent, but it rapidly becomes. But
I'm not focusing. I'm focusing right now on Bill and the stuff that I get out of Intel that tells me how the FPGA and the NEOs work.
Okay.
Well, and I'm trying to make sense out of those things. Yeah.
Because basically the NEOs code is going to run things the way Bill's running things, only with different hardware.
Well, yes. There is a C compiler in the NEOs.
Right.
And it is GCC. The issue is you don't have the same components that you would have on any kind of Linux machine. There's a bunch of things missing.
Well, you have a lot of you're at a lot lower level
than
you are on a Linux machine, where you can just issue a call and to some function and it takes care of everything for you. Well, now you have to do that yourself because there's no function.
Yes.
So then actually you start Bill's code just the top level, and then you have to figure out.
We have to figure out all those other pieces and how to do them.
I think
that's what I'm trying to do in an organized, so that we have a map where we're going. Well, right now we don't have a map.
That'll be really useful if you can do it. That's a hard task.
Yeah. But that's what I've been working on and trying to get my head around. I'll probably be sending Bill a lot of questions.
Bill has enough monitors.
Remember that what I developed was based on that long conversation, Scotty, that you and I had when we were in Orlando.
At Hamcation, yeah.
Yeah, two years ago, whatever the hell it was. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I basically tried to implement that based on what that discussion was that we had.
Yeah.
And it was based on some white paper that somebody else had done. It ran to many, many pages, but it turned out a lot of it was just general discussion, if you remember correctly. Anyway.
It was kind of based on Protocol 2, but it was not Protocol 2.
Right, so. Yeah. Like a simplification of Protocol 2. But anyway.
Yeah,
I guess the problem is that, I mean, the algorithm doesn't require a lot of sophisticated stuff. It's just that it depends on being able to get certain things through off a UDP or TCP or whatever.
Yes.
I mean,
that stuff isn't all there.
That's because you're doing a bare metal installation. Yes. You don't have any drivers or anything.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, but that was going to be an issue. No matter how we do it, because you're anticipating you're going to have this, at the very least, UDP communication between the different parts of the system. So
we just have to do this once.
Right, but we had a discussion about this about 3 months ago. We have to find a way to communicate port numbers in an unambiguous way, because socket programming has some restrictions and we were missing some of those things. So this problem's gone around once or twice already.
But I think, Tom, I think hopefully that protocol that Bill and I discussed a couple of years ago at Hamcation took care of that. I'd like to think that we took care of that.
Well, there's missing things.
Missing, yes.
There are definitely missing ports that we have no way to find.
The idea is that you request a port and you get assigned one. You can't assume that I'm going to have access to any port by default, except for the listening port.
I got to have a way to ask for it.
Yes, there's no way to ask for it.
But I thought isn't that in the protocol, Bill?
I thought so.
Well, okay. We can't, there's a number of port numbers. The first one, I forget what it was, port B. I didn't have a way to find out what it was without doing a listen all, and you can't do a listen all unless you have pseudo.
Okay, there's a whole pile of
things that unroll.
That's an omission then, because that wasn't the intent. The intent was that everything's defined. The only predefined port is the one you listen on, and all communications occurs on assigned ports after that. You request and you get one.
Well,
so if there's missing some way to request one, then we got to fix that.
Precisely.
Well, presumably we can send a port in that reply
Right. You send a port number, you ask for a port number and you get a port number, and then that establishes a path. But you can't assume that you're going to just talk to a particular port. You have to ask for what port it's going to be, because you don't know the availability on the two ends, what ports you're going to be allowed to use.
Well, I think Tom's talking about the reply from 1024.
Yeah. So yeah, there's, you know,
anyway, these are details that we have to work out.
But the only broadcast one is the Discovery. From then on, everything is
that's from
I still have to have a port I can send to you to say, hey, tell me what port I can get. I need a port to program you. Please tell me what that port number is. I have to have a way to do that.
Right. Well, the reply from the Discovery gives you that port.
That's right.
I think it's all there in the protocol.
Yeah, but the machine in the FPGA doesn't have an Ethernet facility or a UDP facility, right?
Well, how do you mean? It does have a UDP facility. That's what we're going to build into the FPGA.
We're going to have to build it. Yes.
Right.
Okay. But I can't remember what the ports are. I've got to go back to the documents that we sent about 3 months ago describing the problem that we were having, not being able to get one or two of the particular port.
Okay, well, yeah, Tom, let's talk about that, because I seem to remember that, and I could kind of didn't get discussed because we were busy doing other things, but let's talk about that now. So,
by the way, at the time, I modified the HPSDR reply to add that port into the reply, the report, but you're still sending it to someplace so that they can read what port to read it from. So it's a chicken and egg thing.
Well, I thought we worked all this out a year ago and everybody was agreed on it. I'm really stunned that everybody's saying something to some moment the protocol now.
Because the thing is, if there's no port for the FPGA to respond to the Discovery, then we have to modify the Discovery broadcast to put a port number in there that he's listening on. If there is, so
and that I did that. I did that with the OpenHPSDR protocol that I was building with a simulator. So there is a way to do that. But
okay, so Tom, let's unbury that and see if I just vaguely remember it. So it'd be good to get that taken care of and. So we all understand that we have it covered.
And by the way, Bill did a nice job of adding some additional diagrams to his document to explain who is listening and who's not listening.
And where.
That is a nice addition that you made in the last revision, Bill.
So, I mean, I thought... like I said, I thought we had figured all this out, and I'm really surprised to think that there's something unknown about this.
Well, it's not unknown. It's how do we translate what you did into the FPGA?
I mean, I know nothing about FPGA programming, but if an FPGA system is not able to communicate on Ethernet, it's
we're out of luck.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be a way to do that. There's got to be libraries. There's got to be some modules that you can call.
Very, very few. Well, you got to kind of think of giving up all the system libraries that you're used to.
We're going to write them ourselves in the FPGA. That's the only way to do it. And it's going to be much easier in NEOS than it will be in state machines. Right. So, I mean, realistically,
I'll try to resurrect the documentation trail. I was hoping we'd have a document that covered this. And we got about 90 or 95% of the way there, as my recollection. So
yes.
I'll try and resuscitate that.
It's when I'm sitting down looking at this again, I'm finding little things that, this doesn't match up.
That we forgot or that we didn't specify?
Well, it all works in the simulator. That's not a problem. Bill has a working simulator. But the radio part in his simulator is sitting on a full-blown Linux.
Right, which means he has access to...
So we have to figure out how do we get things done that you have C, but you don't have a full-blown Linux.
Right. And this is why I don't really want to implement TCP/IP. If we need handshaking, I want to use UDP because it's much easier to build. And the idea is that for the command and control, we use ACT UDP. We build our own fake ACK, which is only just one ACK. There's no retransmission. There's no TCP/IP hard stuff because you got to implement that in the FPGA. And I don't know about you, but I don't really want to write a TCP/IP stack to run under NEOS. That's not going to be, it's kind of like Bill, remember Bill Tracy, not, when people would ask him to write a sound card for the Janus board?
Yes.
And the first thing he would say is, no. I mean, it's like not even in a discussion. Is I'm not doing that. If you want to do it, then you can do it, but I'm not going to do it. So it's just, I don't want to make the FPGA code that hard because it's already going to be hard enough. And
that was the whole reason we went from USB to Ethernet is nobody wanted to rewrite USB drivers.
Yeah. I'm going to have to leave at this time and maybe try to continue this discussion by email.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, bye-bye. Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was the reason we got rid of, that was the reason why we went to UDP as well, because it simplified the housekeeping necessary to do the communication.
Yes. And a UDP stream is much easier to generate. There's no ACKs, there's no retransmissions, there's none of that. So makes it a lot easier. Once I send the packet out, it's gone. I'm done with that one. Move on to the next. But some things like set the frequency need to be ACKed because
yes.
It either gets missed or you ask for something that you can't have or that the radio can't do, then you got to be aware of that.
Well, and Bill, what I'm trying to do is at least write out some of the things that in your diagrams are not explicit, but are explicit in your code. And do it in a way that I can teach somebody else to do it.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be good because when you go to the next data engine that has a different FPGA on it, you have to port the code. You're going to want a spec to port to.
Right. And so...
A detailed spec. I mean, we have a process spec, but we really don't have... You obviously covered the nuances because you got code that works, right?
Right.
So...
And between... Bill's code that works and some code that I wrote later last year, we have lots of the pieces, but we need to have it really clearly explained. This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
And right now in the protocol, there's this little bit of cobbling that's two different kinds of protocols mixed together, which for somebody coming to this new without the history, doesn't make sense.
Well, we need to clarify it and write it down. That's really important.
Yes. And it needs to be written down in enough detail that you can hand it to a programmer and they can write a piece
of code. And guess what? If you write it down, then you are going to figure out whether it works or not.
Right.
Well, what would be helpful is if help me to, I mean, somehow let me know what it is that needs more.
Yes, I will be working with you on this.
Yeah,
but you were busy with this other testing this week, so I didn't bother you with it. But I was going to tonight start to talk to you about it.
Well, we may need to a special workshop to set aside a couple of hours to have a Zoom call during the day or something. See what we can figure out.
So what I'm interested in is writing a document of what the data engine needs to be doing to listen to the protocol that you document. And that's where I'm trying to go right now.
In other words, a document to talk to the local host.
Yes.
Describe the data engine end of it.
Yes. And how it does that. And how it keeps track of where it is.
Like something that we never had for the Hermes board?
Nope. Never.
Well, we won't get into that, shall we? Shall we not?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I didn't attempt it because having no experience in FPGA programming, anything I do would be garbage.
But I don't think it's really necessarily what can the FPGA do, even though it'll have to do it. It's really what needs to be done.
I mean,
it has to be done some way or other. And if you could do it with function calls to the Linux operating system, then you've got your code. If you do it with some other method that doesn't rely on those functions, so we have to dive deeper into what right. actually happens. And I guess you get down to
and what are the actual, I mean, Bill has some of these where actual packets are going back and forth, but not all of them are there.
Yeah. So I think what's going
to happen. I mean, they are in the code because he's talking to some other protocols.
But what I think is going to have to happen is the NEOS processor is going to have to build the headers in memory, because that's going to have the port numbers and the IP addresses and all that. And the FPGA, and then we're going to use a DMA engine to stick the data part on the end and say, okay, now go send that. And then the FPGA takes it and says, ah, okay, there's a block of memory. I'm sending that out.
Yeah.
And you've already made the front end. I don't care what the data is. You put the data in place already.
But again, we also need to keep track of, there's a bunch of agreements that go back and forth, and those have to be stored somewhere in the.
That's right. And there's,
in some sort of a table, basically.
And there's limited storage. So we have to figure out how are we going to deal with the fact that you run out of entries in the table, or, right. I mean, that's going
to. It will probably be just some simplified code to know.
And that's why I say the acts are important. So for instance, if you ask for a new port and the table's full, then you get a knack and you say, sorry, you can't have that because it's full. And in fact, we might have a reason why you can't get it. And one of the things I was toying with is, because we haven't defined this, but if I ask for a particular sample rate, say, and that's something that the hardware can't do, what the hardware could do is to tell me in the ACK what I actually got. So if I ask for some weird sample rate, 208 kilo samples per second, the NAC would come back and say, you got 192K.
Yes.
So, and you know, we could do it that way, or we could just say NAC, and then you figure out what you did wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I did create a table of error messages. I mean, I thought that, you know, it could tell, the FPGA could tell us what is the reason why the request is being rejected.
Right. Yes.
So.
Because actually that's better, because if you give him a knack, the implication is he didn't get what he wanted or didn't get anything.
Yeah.
So if you say, I asked for 208K and I you knack it and give him 192K, well, that's not really a knack then, is it? It's like a modified act. So maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you want to say knack, incorrect baud rate. Or incorrect sample rate, and then he's got to go figure out what the correct ones are. So maybe then you have another query command that says, what are your allowed sample rates?
Right.
And then he can do that command and then pick one of those and then do another request.
So I had another question about the protocol. In HPSDR, we padded things. But if you have at least an end of packet, and well, we were talking about this.
He did that zeros. Because it was easy.
Huh?
Because it was easy in a state machine to take all same size packets.
Right.
But
do we want to do that, or do we want?
Remember he had, even on the discovery packet, he had like a 60 byte length packet.
Right.
I looked and I could find no mention of that requirement in Ethernet at all, ever, anywhere.
No.
And now he claims that he read that somewhere, that 60 bytes minimum was required.
Yeah, I remember that.
But anyway, so then the question is, do we need a 60 byte minimum there? Or can we make the packets variable length with an EO end of packet?
Bill, you have multiple blanks in between things in your protocol. Could we just have an end of line value?
You could use, there's very, we've got a lot of latitude on what we do there, I'm sure. I mean, if you're dealing with, you can make it easier for the Linux programmer.
That's what I would like to do, is I like your idea of making it that you can use Netcat and talk to it.
Yeah, I mean,
I'd like to make it easier on the FPGA because you got a lot more resources on the Linux side than we got on the FPGA yes. side. So for instance, I would like to for when we receive a packet, I'd like an easy way to identify that this is a control packet now that's going to have to be parsed right. by the NEOS as opposed to just shoved out into the memory somewhere.
Right. So, because they're both and this is what I want to do is document all these different types and when to expect these kind of packets to come and when not to expect them.
You're kind of going to the next level because yes. you know what Bill and I defined was a very high level of they purposely left open so that you can have any kind of format you want as long as right. you define it ahead of time. Now it's time to define it ahead of time, right?
Well, and I feel like to be fair to Kong, he's got to be able to understand what's coming at him.
You mean he shouldn't be able to read our minds?
Yeah.
In fact, to figure out the things that we didn't figure out that, well, anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, this is where
So you remember that cartoon where the scientists are looking at the blackboard and they have all these equations written and in the middle it says, and then a miracle occurs?
Yes.
And the other scientist says, I think you need to be a little more specific in this step.
Yes.
So we've got the miracle occurs step with no definition of what yes. that is.
So I'm trying to get the definitions and the flow sequence very, very clearly designed, starting from where Bill starts. I mean, what Bill, if you were a normal programmer in a Linux system, Bill's got a nice description. But I think there's more detail that has to be explained for the FPGA. Yeah.
Well, and maybe some of that detail is going to come about when we write the code. So, Kong, right. you're on your own. You have to figure it out.
Well, I mean, do we have a good handle on what libraries of functionality we have access to in the FPGA? Or in the NEOS or whatever?
We have very, very limited access.
It's going to be a little bit of standard lib, and I think that's about it.
Yeah, like for instance, you do have a printf function, but it is extremely huge, and you really don't want to use it. You rather use etc and putc and do your own formatting, because if some of those functions are really big and they take up lots of ROM to load, so you prefer not to use those functions. And you can pick which functions you want to use when you compile.
So you don't have to load the whole library. You just
no.
put in the functions you want.
We actually had one where I started out with printf and it wouldn't fit.
It's huge.
So I had to take it out and put in getc and putc and format it myself. And it was fine because I don't need all the features of printf. It's just easy, right? Because we all know what that is. But when I switched it now, I mean, it cut the size like down by like 16K. I mean, that sounds like nothing to a Raspberry Pi, but that's big shakes to the FPGA.
Yes.
That's a lot of memory for it. So... because it's in a library with a bunch of other stuff. So when you get rid of it, then you get rid of all those other functions that you weren't using anyway, because it says, oh, printf, okay, that's library A. We'll put it all in. And then you get all these other extraneous functions right. that you really don't want.
So anyway, I'm trying to diagram this out, and I think Bill and I need to work on it back and forth in email for a while and then share what we get.
Yeah.
Is that okay, Bill?
Well, it's okay with me. My handicap is that I don't have enough experience with the FPGA, in other words, none, to know what's even reasonable to ask for.
So, well, that's why we're going to talk about it.
But really, what the functionality we want to reproduce is the functionality of DE control and DE sim2. Those two C pieces.
Well, yeah, but that's from sounds like from what you're saying, that's a tall order. It sounds
and that's using a whole bunch of libraries. Now, Kong, did you get a link to where those two files are?
The GitHub? Is it the one?
I gave you the GitHub where it was and the subdirectory to look in.
Are you talking about the documentation or?
Not the documentation, just the simulator. Did I send you that or not?
No, you just sent me the link to the GitHub and the Hermes diagram.
Yeah.
Those were the two.
So I could share that C code with you. I mean, it's there. It's just that's what we have to somehow reproduce. But it's a C program that simulates what the DE does.
Well, it was intended to, I mean, I wrote that without knowing what limitations we have on the, I mean, we may have to make some accommodations or
right.
based on what the FPGA subsystem can do and can't do. So,
this is, I think I can contribute here. And so what I'm trying to do is interface between the two of you to help. And then based on my HPSDR experience.
Yeah.
So anyway, I guess we scared everybody else off.
It was a pretty scary discussion.
Yes.
It was. So,
but I wanted you to understand that we need to do this or it's hard to make headway.
Well, whenever you need to do a Zoom, I mean, let's do it.
Yeah. You're done teaching, right? Huh?
You're done teaching, right?
Yes, I'm done teaching.
Yeah. So.
So
anytime. And anytime works for me too, other than times like tomorrow morning at 9 when I have a dentist appointment.
My wife had a dentist appointment this morning. So.
Daniel, we're still on for Wednesday, right?
For meeting with Kung?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're able to do it, that would probably be good.
I should be able to do it.
Okay. Kung, do you have any questions or updates for them?
I do have some questions, but they're going to be very, very fundamental compared to whatever they were talking about before.
we haven't scared you off, at least.
So I was looking through the Angelina code, as Dave mentioned before. So I looked at the functionality described by the comments in here, and it says that this will be the interface between, the LTC 3208 to a PC.
Okay.
Yeah. So what it is, that is a piece of FPG. I told him not to look at Hermes because Hermes won't load. You have to go back and get like Cortis 13 or something to load Hermes because it's written for a Cyclone 3.
But what you could do is you could just change the part to a Cyclone 5 and you won't be able to compile anything, but you can still look at the code.
But you can also go to Angelia, which is a Cyclone 4, and it's just Hermes.
Okay.
Okay. So I told him, look at the Angelia project, and you can go in there. It's just Hermes, but it's written for
Cyclone 4.
So then in there, you can look at things, but you have to remember the protocol is going to be different. But in general, you can see the structure of the code. There's a bunch of registers and a bunch of functions to take input and figure out where to put that.
Okay.
So, and then what I want to do is give you Bill's example that is written in C on Linux, and you should be able to read C on Linux, right?
Yeah.
And that code, he wrote it as a simulator for himself. So there are some things in there that are they're a little cryptic, I guess I should say, Bill.
Well, the whole idea was it was just going to be a...
it was just a simulator for himself.
It's a learning experience to figure out the way Bill did it and the way Bill did it.
So then you've got Bill's code. And then what we have to do is figure out how to implement those steps in the at least part of the FPGA. So like the first thing is to figure out the discovery. So we'll send a packet and when we get that packet, so we got to have some way to read an a UDP packet. And when we get that packet and parse it and then have some sort of answer. I don't know what this is
right?
Yeah, right. So that's going to be one of the first tasks, is to figure out how to do that.
And then the next one is erase and program.
Yeah. Well, the erase and program, programming is really simple because you just give it a block of memory and you're moving it to a different place. So those tasks are fairly
straightforward. But you still have to recognize the packet and
yes,
put the memory somewhere and then program it. And
then put it in the place where it wants to be based on the MAX-10
and then
protocols.
Pass a pointer to it, or you may end up having to write one location at a time. Yeah. I haven't found a bulk write in the MAX-10 IP library.
Okay.
It's a 32-bit write, I think, so it's actually 4 bytes at a time.
Okay.
But it's not what you'd like. You'd like to just point a pointer to the buffer and say, load that sector, but no such luck.
Well, I saw something in there that you could use other protocols to move memory, and I didn't get very far with that, but
I'm talking about programming the flash.
The flash, moving things into the flash. There was, if you switch to a different protocol, you can move bigger chunks of flash, it sounded like.
Okay, maybe, but I think, I'm not positive of this, but I think that has to do with only with user memory. You can't do it in the program memory. Anyway, I may be wrong, but I mean, I know that we tried to do this with another customer and we finally just gave up and did it word at a time because we could not find a utility that actually would work for MAX-10.
Okay.
So if we could find one, that'd be great. But we can always make a subroutine.
Well, let's start with that.
Yeah. And the problem being is that you have to be sure and act. You have to wait until every write is finished before you do the next one.
Right.
Otherwise, it doesn't work. And it's not clear in the code that that's what you have to do, but in the description of the function.
Yes. And we do need to run a CRC on the whole thing, which it sounded like is possible.
That's not hard at all.
So
you're just XORing.
Really, the thing you need to be learning, Kong, is the MAX-10, the specific architecture relative to what you already know.
Okay.
And you did get cord is 20.1.1?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I've put up all the documentation that I send to Kong. So if those of you who are still hanging around, you have plenty of spare time, you can follow along and learn it. It's all under the DE in the Tangerine SDR components link. That's it. We should stop because it's 2 hours almost.
We should stop before we're all scared off.
Before all of our brains melt.
Yeah, it's.
I'm sorry I brought this up, but I'm getting nervous about this. So it has to be done to make our goal.
Yeah, one step at a time. We'll see how far we can get with the current proposed architecture and protocol and see. I mean, the first step would be to make this thing come alive and be able to just simply respond to a discovery packet. I mean, if you can do that much, you're on the
that's kind of good to be that's kind of be required for the self-test because the easiest thing to do to test the Ethernet logic is to just connect
to something. Yes,
connect to something, because if you can't do that, I mean, you can pass all the tests in the world, the connectivity tests, but if you can't connect, it's useless. And my experience with Hermes, we had boards that we could not connect to that everything looked perfect on.
Yes,
but yet we couldn't connect because there was some, I never did really figure out what the problem was on some of those boards. There was a handful of boards out of the 4,000 boards that we've shipped. There's a handful, and I mean literally like 6 or 8 boards that I could not get to recognize a discovery packet, and I could not figure out why. And I mean, it's only a few lines, data lines, because it's just connecting the chips, the PHY and the Ethernet and the FPGA together. And yet it wouldn't work.
Yeah,
it would time out. You know how the light would flash quickly, which says I tried, but I couldn't connect, so I'm timing out. And so, if you want a want some head banging experience, I'll send you some boards. You can see if you can fix them.
It sounds like component problems in there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and you know, I'm pretty tenacious. I don't give up easily because every other board we made, we got 100% yield. So yes. It really wrecks my record to have these five or six boards that I can't make work. And I don't know why.
Hermes boards?
No, they're, what do you call it?
Metis?
Metis boards.
Well, you know, even Nick Saban, he's had years he didn't win a national championship. So,
well, and you know what? Interesting.
There haven't been that many of them, but he has had them.
I think I know what's wrong, and it's probably best that they don't get fixed because
yes.
We had some, an area of the board between the PHY and the FPGA where I had traces go open. Now, those boards passed electrical test. So those traces were not open when they were fabricated, but yet they test open with an ohmmeter after the board, after I can't get the board to work.
Yes.
So it has to do with flexing of the board, hairline cracks that maybe got into the inner layer optical or something. And it's interesting that all of the six boards have failures in the same area. So it's this area of the board, a small little half square inch area that has inner layer problems. And I actually managed to fix one or two boards by adding wires, but it rapidly gets out of control and you just can't put wires on every pin. So you just give up because it's not worth it. And we actually had one, a French guy bought a Metis and he used it for a year. And then it just one day it wouldn't boot anymore. And so I said, well, send it back to me. And I looked and it had the same problem these other boards did that had opens. And so I just sent him another board because there's no way you can fix that.
I think I've got one of those.
Yeah.
I have one that I've run for eight or 10 years and it just stopped working.
Yeah, that's what happened to him.
And I can reprogram the FPGA and it does it successfully.
Really?
But it won't answer a discovery.
Now that's bizarre. Because
do you have the boards electrically tested when they're the PC boards when they're made?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. I wonder if there's like a piece of dust on the Gerber or something like that.
Well, that's what I was thinking. And we actually took them back and had them x-rayed. I took them back to the CM and I said, look, I got five or six boards that don't work. And it's all in the same area. Look inside and see if you can see. And they could not find anything. They couldn't find any cracks, any shorts, anything like that in the area that I told them to look. So, but yeah, we always pay for electrical tests. It's too scary to not do that.
Oh, I know. Ben might have done that.
So that's why I was surprised when I get boards that electrically don't work. You know, that's how can that be? I had them tested. And especially ones like Dave and the French guy's board that work for a year and then stop.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of boards that had hairline traces, shorts in between traces. I got good at using a 5-volt, 20-amp power supply to blow them out.
That's the thing is that you could detect those with an ohmmeter, right?
Yes, those you could.
I couldn't detect them. I could detect opens. There are.
It sounds like a trace just has a really it must neck down at some point and it fatigues.
Yeah.
And you know maybe it was over etched or I don't know what happened.
I mean. Anyway, we should stop. We're at 2 hours.
Look, there's one more little thing. Scotty, do you have another magnetometer? In your inventory, you could send me. Nathaniel requested that I build up a second system to pair with the grape.
Oh, okay. And Nathaniel, I sent yours out last week, so you should be there anytime now. Finally, thanks. Huh?
Yeah, and I'll work out fine. Majid's on vacation this week, so he'll be back next week to work on.
Okay. Yeah. So I have. I think I have five more, Nathaniel. Five more pairs.
All right.
So do you want me? I don't know where you have them earmarked, but they're just sitting here not doing any good. So I might as well send one to Bill if he can use it.
Yeah, no, definitely send them to Bill. So
yeah,
I think the people who have them seem to be doing good things with them. Yeah. So
Bill, do you need more than one set? Can you use more than one or is one good enough?
Well, one more pair for now. And what I can actually do is we can have some fun with this. I can hook it up and get it collecting data on the grape, but I can provide all of the data to Dave Witten's system, and we can do some comparison to see how the two different systems, if they produce the same results, sitting in my yard.
Next to each other.
Yeah, I'll have them separated a little bit, but, you know, if they're benched basically within the same geographical area.
Well, Jules has hooked up some that with, in the same pipe even.
Yes, he's got doubles in pipes, just trying to understand how similar they are.
So you could
theoretically, if you put multiples in, you can do a wheelbarrow interferometer.
Yeah. The interferometer group has really gone.
So they're
ready to design the next one.
So you want me to send you a couple of them? Is that okay, Nathaniel? I don't want to cut off anybody who's on the list for getting one, but it seems like they've been sitting there for a while. So
yeah, no, we don't have a particular list for these. So definitely send it to Bill.
Okay,
yeah, just one more for me. I just need another, you know, the base module and the remote module. I don't need a two pair. I just one set.
Yeah,
and it actually comes then, with a magnetometer, but daughter card too. So you have the whole setup.
Yeah, and then just hang on to the others, because there will be someone else who comes up and says, I need one because of whatever reason. Jules probably needs a, you know.
You're just convincing me that for data engines, I don't want to be the one distributing them. So
that's
actually the Bruce, the guy from the Tapper office, has offered to be the mail order clearinghouse for all the data engine.
Oh, that's good.
Wonderful.
So we put them all in the box and send them to him, and then you tell him where to send the individual ones, and he sends them out one at a time.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, and then I don't have to do it. He's all set up for mailing anyway, so it's much easier.
Good.
Because we have to do it one at a time. Got to go find a box. That's why I'd rather send you two, Bill, than send you one this week and one in 3 weeks.
Yeah,
I could put them both in the same box.
I mean, if you need someone to do that kind of distribution for this stuff too, I mean, I can have Lori, our administrative assistant person, do that sort of thing as well. So
okay,
yeah, she is very good at helping. But thank you for sending that to me. So I will look for that.
Okay.